Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is John Sharp, Texas A&M University System Chancellor. I taught Ross Ramsey everything he knows, but I didn't teach him everything I know. Here's Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Chancellor Sharp. Please pardon the noise. That was recorded in the midst of South by Southwest EDU, where he was on a panel. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the first full week of March, maybe the second week of March. It's a week in March. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Who didn't learn everything I know from old marble mouth, but I appreciate the greeting.
What do you think he knows that he didn't teach you?
I don't know. That'd sort of be the definition, wouldn't it?
I guess so. This definite theme with university system chancellors having concerns or thoughts about your knowledge.
Former candidates picking on the reporters who taunted them while they were running, I think is how that goes. Kent Hance, John Sharp.
Also joining us is Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
And reporter Morgan Smith.
Hello.
And we'll be talking about politics and schools, not necessarily in that order, but probably, because we're going to start with politics right now. We are a day after the Super Tuesday primaries, which barely affect Texas at all, really.
Right. Turnout was zero, as it turns out, in Texas.
Rick Perry did crack 1% of the vote in, was it Ohio? One of the states.
Oh, did he? I didn't
know. Yeah, for the first time he's cracked 1%. So congratulations to the governor.
We would have been a player. I mean, this would have been really sort of interesting. You know, Texas would have been a contender here. It would have been an important state. I assume, just from our polling and from what happened in neighboring states, that this would have probably been a big Santorum battleground. And, you know, Texas, you know, would have thrown some votes into this thing. We've gone to proportional voting this time, so it's not a winner-take-all state. So Santorum could have taken away some numbers. Ron Paul has never done particularly well statewide in Texas. It could have been kind of interesting.
But it's not a week without any political news at all. It's still been pretty exciting. One of the most noteworthy things, I think, was probably Representative Lozano's party switch. What happened there? What does it mean? Julian, take us away.
What happened there was he basically said he needed to do it after the new maps came out. He said he had a conservative voting record during the last session anyway. He said he's pro-gun, he's pro-life, he's pro-oil and gas. Apparently George P. Bush, the nephew of George W. Bush and the son of Jeb Bush, had a significant role. They had a conversation.
Any relation to H.W. Bush?
Yes.
Grandson.
Here we go with the little brown one.
What kind of grandson?
One of the little brown ones.
Right.
So they had a conversation.
His term, not ours.
His term, yes. Yeah. I can't believe people still don't know that. It's not our term. So they had a conversation over the weekend, and Mr. Lozano said that, I guess that was, that's what put him over the edge to decide. He's having a
Had he never talked to George P. Bush before?
I don't think so.
It was just this one guy.
I guess the push was on. And this is an interesting race because he was one of the guys. This is a classic case of not dancing with the people who brung you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was the guy. Trial lawyers and others put like $140,000 into his race against Haro.
Ibadra.
Right. Yeah. In the primaries 2 years ago and beat back the TLR Democrat, the Texans for Lawsuit Reform Democrat. So he was he came in with the Democrats.
Yeah, he did. And he, you know, it'd be interesting to see what he has to say when he announces this officially at a press conference coming up on Thursday. You know, he's going to be flanked by the speaker and George P. Bush. When we spoke on the phone a couple of days ago, he still seemed he was choosing his words carefully. He did seem to, I guess, take some talking points, though. He said, you know, his district is very pro-oil and gas. If the EPA and Obama had their way, those towns would be, you know, would be empty. They'd be ghost towns. So he's already sort of kind of picking up that jargon. Whether there's talking points, whether he felt that way, who knows. But he's making the switch, and we'll see what happens because, as Ross reported today, Yvonne Gonzalez-Torre, former state rep from Alice, filed yesterday to run as a Democrat in HD 43. So,
but if this affects his political future, he would be more the exception than the rule. Right? I mean, party switching historically hasn't seemed to have hurt that many people.
Well, party switching's hard. I mean, you know, a lot of people that switch parties get beat. Aaron Pena's not going to run again.
He didn't get beat, though.
Well, but he was looking at the map. You know, one of the conversations going on, and I'm sure you heard in your reporting, was that Lozano thought he was going to get an opponent in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
And maybe Yvonne Gonzalez Touré, and you know, maybe just moved that fight from May to November by his party switch. It's still a marginally Democratic district. It's a swing district, and it usually votes Democratic in presidential years. So he's got a little bit of an uphill road.
There were some comparisons made to Representative Benyus, which some people were saying, you know, Mr. Lozano's a freshman. You know, he didn't have as much rank as Aaron did. Aaron was 3 or 4 terms into it before he switched parties.
Right.
But on the flip side, people are saying, well, at least Representative Lozano switched before the election, not after the election, the way Representative Benyus did. Who knows what difference that would have made had he chosen to switch right before.
Can people look at him switching as a sign that the Republican Party is becoming more appealing to Hispanics?
If he wins.
Yeah.
That's the whole pitch that George P. is making, right?
Yeah.
Well, and they're to a point in Texas where you can't draw Republican seats on any of these maps until you start winning minority votes. They've drawn the maximum number of non-minority seats they can draw. And so unless you start attracting black votes and brown votes, you're not going to win.
Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, though, this was the way the lines are now. In 2008, it was a Democratic seat. In 2010, it was more for McCain. So, you know, whether ethnicity or the way Republicans are trying to court Latinos is a factor, it's still kind of up in the air. But yeah, like Ross said, I mean, if he wins, then obviously that's going to be a big coup d'etat for the Republican Party.
You know, likewise, the Democrats aren't going to change the number of seats they've got unless they start winning in Anglo districts. You know, we've sort of got these maps set, and this is sort of, you know, just the way it's fallen right now. This is the maximum number of minority opportunity seats. It's also the maximum number of the other kind, right?
Sure.
And so the parties have to cross that line.
Has he changed positions on anything?
Lozano?
Yeah.
He hadn't been in office long enough to really have a bunch of positions established.
No, and I asked him, I said, you voted with the party on two of the more volatile issues during the 82nd, Sanctuary Cities and voter ID. And he said Sanctuary Cities.
He voted with the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party, yeah. And I said, you know, how do you explain that? How are you going to explain it when you're campaigning? And he said Sanctuary Cities was a no vote for him because nobody could prove that a sanctuary city existed. He said, had you had sheriffs and police officers testify, yes, we are a sanctuary city, he might have changed his mind, is what he said. Voter ID, he said it didn't do enough. There's a free ID provision that the Texas Department of Public Safety will give you only for the purpose of voting. But he thought if there was a mechanism in voter ID that made a state-issued ID an all-in-one, then he maybe would have voted for voter ID. So he explained that those were his two no votes in line with the party on that, and that's how he's going to explain it when he campaigns if he ever gets questioned on, you know, being soft, I guess.
So are those his only two votes on major issues that he voted with Democrats and not the Republicans?
There was some discussion about the redistricting. I'm not exactly sure how that went down, but obviously it was a factor because he switched parties after these maps were put into place. But again, you know, he was a freshman. Everybody knows the clout that freshmen have, especially in the House.
Which not is, a lot.
Exactly. So whether people kind of, you know, thought that he was a major player or not, who knows.
But I mean, the sort of the line of my question was just, I mean, Ross, maybe you can answer this. Why does party matter at all? If he's still the same guy, why should Democrats not vote for him now, and why should Republicans vote for him now?
Well, I mean, you know, what you're doing when you switch parties is you're basically, you know, when people are voting for parties or when they're voting straight tickets, they don't necessarily pay attention to your individual achievements. The theory when you change parties is that, you know, I can do everything right as a member of the party I'm in and still lose the election. And I think my base chances are better if I'm in the other party. If you're in one of these South Texas districts, though, like Lozano's district, like Peña's district last time, it's a risky bet because there are so many people that vote straight ticket Democrat in those places that you have to first overcome that. Second, they have to know who you are and how you vote. And third, they have to agree with it. So Lozano's just, I just think he's looking at this and saying, I think my odds are better given the opposition and the district in the Republican primary than in the Democratic primary. And I know, I mean, you know, one of the calculations you make if you're making a switch right now is I know that the party's going to help me out. They're going to send George P. Bush down here. They're going to raise some money from me. The speaker's going to come in and help me announce this thing and then help me after the election. I may just be building a better campaign this way.
And his Lozano's former campaign manager, Ken Flippin, said that, I mean, what you said, Ruby, you know, he has the ability to go down there and talk to some people and say, yeah, I switch parties, but I'm still the same guy, maybe get some votes that are traditionally D votes to still support him. But what Mr. Flippin was saying is that they are still, the Democratic Party is still confident that during the general election that people are just going to vote straight ticket or just, you know, see the D by a person's name and, you know, not think about the person, just the letter, and vote that way. So,
because there are no individuals, it's just two big machines.
Well, just two letters.
He just lined up. I mean, think about how he lined up here. He's gonna, you know, there's the presidential race, obviously, and then people are gonna look at their ballots, and the things that are around him on the ballot are mostly lean toward the Democrats. Mm-hmm. He's gonna be running behind a Democratic incumbent senator. He's gonna be running behind a Democratic incumbent member of Congress. You know, the blue jerseys will be out. It's going to be a tough race.
Sure.
There's not a sure calculation then.
Right.
Anyone else fixing to go down that path? Any other party hoppers this time around?
I don't know. I mean, you know, just for the moment, the Republicans can claim 102 in the Texas House. That's a, you know, a historic high, I guess, since Reconstruction.
It's been a while.
We're in the middle of the week of filing. You know, when they drew the new maps and the court put them out, they said, okay, you can file through the 9th of March. And you know, we're seeing people jump all over the place. Ken Legler, state representative, I think a two-term state rep from Pasadena, is dropping out. He's not going to seek re-election. Todd Smith, a state representative from Euless, who's been talking about running for the state senate, is jumping into that race. So there's three House members running in the empty seat where Chris Harris is retiring. Kelly Hancock and Rodney Anderson are the other two. And I think we'll see those through the end of the day Friday. We'll see people hopping in and out of races.
What's going on in your hometown? Talk about that.
My hometown.
Our hometown.
The district where I yeah, your hometown too.
Morgan's hometown also.
We're gonna get a rematch between Dee Margo and Joe Moody. Joe Moody had this seat, and it kind of jumps the mountain. It's between West El Paso and Northeast El Paso, and it's marginally, it depends on the year. It's a Republican seat, it's a Democratic seat, it's a Republican seat. It was held for a long time by Pat Hagerty, who was, if there is such a thing, a liberal Republican, you know, sort of an El Paso Republican. So DeMargo's trying to hold on to it. Moody, they drew the map so that Moody's no longer in the district, but he put out a statement basically saying, me and the wife are packing up, we're going to move into this district and run against Margo again. So rematch.
Is that a surprise?
He was talking about also, you know, the other thing he could have done was stay where he is and run against Marissa Marquez, who's got some problems in the Democratic primary, I think. And I talked to him or, you know, back and forth, went back and forth with him earlier this week, and he was trying to decide which of the districts to run in. So she's probably exhaling now, relaxing a little bit. Although Norma Chavez, another former rep, has been kind of kicking around, and she could turn up and run against Marissa Marquez, which would be another rematch.
Sure. And by we, I mean Evan, are probably just, you know, crossing our fingers and hoping she does that, because she always makes for good news.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, El Paso politics are really, really interesting this year. Beto O'Rourke is running against Sylvester Reyes in Congress, and in the last three or four elections, we've shown that incumbency doesn't really mean much out there, that people will change their minds and, okay, let's do something else. I mean, it's really kind of competitive.
So if you're looking for fireworks, set your clocks to mountain time, I guess.
Yeah, that congressional race is going to be, it's already interesting. You got a lot of mudslinging about he smokes pot or he advocates for legalization and I'm trying to fight, you know, against this. This is the Beto Silver thing that's been going on back and forth. I think a Moody Marquez thing would have been quite interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, I guess Representative Pickett is going to be the ranking member of the delegation because Chente Quintanilla is opting out. And that's going to be an interesting race as well.
Right, right.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of really interesting races in El Paso County and a bunch of really interesting races in Tarrant County. Those are kind of the hotbeds this time.
Yeah. And if Joe Moody ends up winning and one of the candidates out in HC 75, Mary Gonzalez, it's going to be a rather young delegation as well. I don't other than Representative Pickett, I don't think anybody that's running or that's was elected last time is older than, you know, their early 30s. So that'd be interesting to see how it plays out, because the youth vote is going to be very important in El Paso mm-hmm. for the O'Rourke and the Silver race.
Right.
Is that, you know, you always hear about the rural-urban divide in the House. Is there an age divide, too, a generational gap?
Yeah, young people don't vote. And so, you know, when they do vote, you get unusual results. So one of the things that happened in the Democratic primary in 2008 was young people voted and Hillary Clinton lost. You know, the expectation given normal voting patterns and the people who vote and all of that sort of argued for her But if you can get a youth vote out, then you can
change the results. But do the young representatives vote any different from the old representatives? Does their perspective change things at all?
I don't think so. I don't know. That'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah, well, obviously we have no idea
here. We don't have that many young representatives.
Well, speaking of young people, let's transition to schools. Why don't we? Morgan, you have been tracking the...
Tell us about schools.
Yeah. Are you for them or against them? No, last time we sort of touched on the school finance lawsuits. I don't think we knew much about them, but we did talk about it on the podcast anyway. You know, what are the main issues at hand and how are those going?
Well, we now have 5 school finance lawsuits. The latest one to be filed was, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, really through kind of a twist into the arguments that all the different plaintiffs are going to be making. Until then, we kind of had the usual suspects who have been involved in many rounds of the school finance litigation, probably dating like for at least the past decade. And the traditional arguments that those groups make are that the state has failed to adequately fund the schools to meet the standards that they set as far as accountability is concerned, and also that by shouldering less and less of the financial burden that they've in effect created a de facto property tax across the state because districts don't really have any choice of whether or not to raise property taxes to fund schools. But this latest group has an interesting argument, and they're saying, and they're looking at the efficiency of the system. They're saying that the way that the state has funded the schools and the way that schools use the money is wildly inefficient. And that's kind of the third prong of what's in the Constitution for funding public education. And then they kind of bring in, they have several suggested remedies to the problem. And a lot of that focuses on supporting more charter schools, like lifting the number of charters that can be granted to schools. And then also lifting, kind of making it so traditional districts can operate more like charter schools that don't have regulations on, as many regulations on teacher contracts and class sizes and things like that.
Is there an obvious way to harmonize all of that? Is there an obvious, did this fifth lawsuit jump in a way that says you can solve those other 4 lawsuits by doing our thing?
Well, that's the thing is, all 5 of these groups are going to be on the same side of the court, on the same side of the courtroom, but they have kind of slightly different arguments. The one area where this fifth lawsuit aligns with the other 4 is on the property tax. And I think maybe the court could work out some type of remedy that addresses some of the charter school issues that this group brings up. But the adequacy, whether or not schools have enough funding is not really mentioned at all in this lawsuit. They don't say that, they don't disagree that that schools don't have enough funding, but they kind of say that's not our issue. There is, bureaucratic waste in the system to be corrected, and that's, what we should be focusing on.
How much of their efficiency argument is aimed at that, though? Are they saying if the schools were more efficient, they wouldn't need more money?
I think that's kind of the next step, but they're being careful not to say that in their filings. Okay. And when they kind of talk to when they talk to me, and I should say who they is, it's a group called there's a group that is led by the former House Public Education Chairman Kent Grusendorf, who was very influential on public education policy, and he was defeated in 2006 after kind of a very contentious battle over school finance that involved vouchers, and defeated by Diane Patrick, who ran on kind of a I'm education friendly platform. So just kind of an interesting note that he's a player.
Do they have to make the case that in the fifth lawsuit, the Waiting for Superman lawsuit, as some people have termed it, will they have to make the case that charter schools are inherently better than traditional schools? And will that be a tough or easy case to make if they have to do it?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think if they can show that, I think what they'll be trying to show is that the current system is inefficient. I don't know that they'll have to say that, you know, what we've proposed is the right way to solve it. I think they'll probably be focusing on saying, well, you know, look at all this waste that's happening. If they do try and venture into that territory, I think, you know, a good thing to look at was a recent House public ed meeting that was on charter schools, where you did have House members kind of questioning, well, you know, how do we know that charter schools can produce a better outcome? You know, we need to study this more. You know, a lot of times they're dealing with kids who, you know, don't have the same type of challenges as public school kids. And, you know, is it really wise to be applying what they do to the entire education system?
Well, and wasn't that one of the knocks on the movie Waiting for Superman, which was a really nicely made movie,
yeah.
You know, very compelling, but it got, you know, a few jabs at it because, well, for one, it used some, people said, misleading statistics. And for two, I mean, you can do this thing where you sort of cherry pick the best performing charter schools.
Right.
And we happen to have a lot of them in Texas, a lot of examples that people throw out. Yes, Prep, KIPP,
Idea.
The Harmony Schools, the Idea School that they've been fighting about in Austin forever, it seems
right.
like.
Well, so are they asking the court to order more charter schools, to knock down something that prevents there being more charter schools, or are they basically advancing an argument that they think they could take from the court to the legislature to create more charter schools?
I think they would like the court to knock down this cap. It's around 200, but it limits the number of charter schools that can be opened. And Dan Patrick carried legislation during this past session to kind of handle that. That didn't really get anywhere.
Speaking of Dan Patrick, is he going to be the next chairman of Senate Education?
I think he's probably very interested in that position. Kel Seliger as well. So that will be an interesting.
This is with Florence Shapiro stepping in. I don't think David Dewhurst is going to name anybody to anything until he sees how the primaries go.
Right, back to what you were saying before.
But anyways, I think it would be nice if the court ordered that, but then I think it also kind of brings this issue back into the public spotlight and into the whole discussion about school finance in a way that it wouldn't have been had this lawsuit not been raised, and that could be, you know, a vehicle for getting it in front of lawmakers.
Do these guys, do the legislators you talk to and the lawyers in these lawsuits that you talk to seem to think that they're going to get something out of the courts before the next legislative session?
No. These cases are going to go, or the case is going to go to trial in the fall.
They're going to consolidate all five?
Yeah. That's what they're going to, at least everybody's going to be in the courtroom at the same time with the same judge. But probably permitted to make slightly different arguments. So it's going to trial in the fall, and then it's going to end up at the Texas Supreme Court because everybody's going to appeal. And so there probably won't even be a preliminary decision on that until the summer after the session would hopefully or supposedly end. But if you ask lawmakers about that, they aren't going to say, you know, no, we're not going to touch school
right.
finance. They say, no, of course we're going to, you know, it doesn't matter what the court says. This is an important issue and we need to look at it. And we've seen that there's been this joint interim committee named with lots of people from the House and Senate on it. So,
but is there any way that all this could be wrapped up before the next session?
That's what I just asked.
No.
I was asking to follow up. I wanted a no answer.
This is something for all the lawyers to do now that redistricting has come to an end.
Yeah.
So scurry off to the next lawsuit.
Yeah.
So what do we do in the next session then? Did you just ask that too?
We'll just hang out and wait. Yeah.
What were you doing for the last
talking to
five
our
minutes?
Producer Todd. Trying to figure out.
Drawing on the whiteboard.
So the answer is no. What else is going on in schools? No, you've been looking at teachers getting fired, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not saying that you have any influence on teachers getting fired. I'm just saying you've been looking into that.
Yeah, so the TEA is getting ready to release the official numbers on what employment looks like in all the districts across the state, and this has been highly anticipated among some crowds because it kind of says, you know, how it's. I guess it's a window into just how bad the budget cuts could have been. You know, were education groups crying wolf during the session when they said, you know, 30,000 people were going to lose their jobs in school districts, or is that something that's going to be borne out in these numbers? And what from what I've seen, teachers have lost their jobs, but a lot of people have said, well, they're not, it's not as many as expected. I think it's about 11,000. There's 11,000 fewer teachers this year than last. But that doesn't take account for, and that's about 3.2% less. But that doesn't take into account the teachers that would have been hired if enrollment growth would have been funded.
That's just from a flat number that they've lost about 11,000.
Yeah.
And is that lost even more than that is against what they would have had to hire in
right.
a normal
circumstance. And that's between right. some it's the estimates of how many teachers they would have had to hire between like 2,000 and 8,000 depending on what you look at.
Is that just sort of the raw number of teachers, or is it full-time teachers, part-time count?
Yeah, it's like full-time equivalent. Right. So yeah, it's they don't have like the part-time people. There's like teacher's aides that are in like a different category, which will also cut. The other interesting thing about that data is that there wasn't like a category of employees that like, you know, didn't take any cuts. Like school districts were making cuts across the board, from teachers to administrators to librarians, and so, you know, nobody was really safe from budget cuts.
So let me ask you a question, Mr. Hamilton. How did we get from our hippie music festival, South by Southwest, to South by Southwest Edu, where all these
chancellors are coming, all these
chancellors are coming in?
Is it
a bunch of hippies sitting around listening to chancellors, or has this gone mainstream?
You're assuming that those are two different groups.
Well, yeah.
No, this is the second year of South by Southwest EDU. Right. It's doubled in size in terms of people attending, and it's basically a bunch of education technology people getting together in rooms and talking about education technology. I went to a panel with John Sharp and other A&M officials and their local community college representatives. It was pitched as what is the future of university systems, although it was really talking about cost of college and whether or not they could provide $10,000 degrees like Rick Perry challenged them to almost a year ago. And they say they can. They say at Texas A&M San Antonio, they say they already are. Of course, it's a partnership with Alamo Colleges, so you can't just go straight to a university. You can't go straight to A&M San Antonio anyway because it's an upper division institution. But, it's just a big thing. Morgan and I both went yesterday, and we saw LeVar Burton of Reading Rainbow, mm-hmm. Star Trek, and Roots fame talk about, you know, the magic of storytelling and whatnot. It's an interesting event.
You guys get paid for this. Yeah.
There's going to be a Reading Rainbow app, by the way, which is kind of cool.
Which is, my seven-year-old dream come true. I dreamt that there would be iPhones and apps and that there would be a Reading Rainbow one. Now I'm just waiting for the Ghost Rider app. If any of you remember that show.
Yes, that was a good show.
Ross?
I'm still waiting for the Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Green Jeans app.
I was surprised that the Van Halen reunion tour sold out.
You don't know about Mr. Green Jeans?
No, what is Mr. Green Jeans?
That's for a different podcast.
Children.
I think that was in black and white.
It was in black and white. Thank you very much. That's why they had to tell you what color the jeans.
I was going
to
say, so how could you say it?
No, but South by Southwest EDU is interesting. It's very technology focused. Someone was asking me yesterday, why are there no teachers on the advisory board for this 3-day conference? It's all, you know, software company CEOs and things, which is a legitimate question. I don't know the answer to it.
That's where the money is.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. A lot of people that are involved in the business of education. Right.
The head of Pearson is talking today.
Yeah.
Hey, it's a good event. You know, not quite the same volume and excitement maybe as the music.
As the Perez
or the
Hilton
interactive
finale on Saturday.
Yeah, but Morgan and I at least don't get passes to those.
Yeah.
Although we would talk about them on the podcast if we did, I'm sure, if anyone from South by Southwest is
presenting
listening.
Presenting the embittered sounds of Reeve Hamilton.
We should quickly dip into our mailbag, since we do that now. If you'd ever like to contribute, you can just tweet something with the hashtag TribCast or post something on our Facebook wall. But the question today is about the judicial emergencies in Texas. What does that mean? Asking what that means. Seems to know.
Yeah, some of the Democrats are pushing the Republican senators and the Republican Senate to start approving nominees from the Obama administration to federal judgeships in Texas. Basically say they've too many slots open, too many cases going unheard, this is piling up, it's kind of a wreck, do something. That's the short form.
Are they going to do something? Do we know?
They haven't yet. 3 years in.
I know that the Southern District of Texas, which is based out of Houston but also includes Laredo, has been, I mean, there's a tremendous backlog for years and years because of all the immigration cases that they have to see coming through that part of Texas. So that'd be, I mean, they've been hooting and hollering about needing more help down there for years and years. So be interesting.
Yeah. Every appointment, I mean, this sort of goes across administrations. Every appointment has become a trading chit. Mm-hmm. And so if you need other things, you hold these judges hostage and don't approve them. When they get their deals, it's interesting. Whenever they get a deal, you know, they just squirt out a bunch of judges really quick. It's like there wasn't any controversy. It's, you know, 99
Morgan,
votes for them.
Morgan is taking issue with your use of
Fine.
The word squirt.
Squirt.
Well, one thing that is never backlogged is our inbox. So if you'd like to email questions or comments to us, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. Or once again, you can tweet us or Facebook message us at, you know, the various addresses for those things. In the meantime, on behalf of Ross, Morgan, Julian, and myself, and our producer Todd, thanks for listening. Okay. Here I am. I'm recording.